At BIMTube, our mission is clear: to elevate your digital knowledge. We deep dive into exploring the value of digital and data with conversations that not only inspire, but also instigate better information management.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the BIMTube podcast. My name is Stephen, and today I'm delighted to have with me Anil Sahani, who's from RICS. So welcome, Anil.
Absolutely. So my name is Anil Sahani. Currently, I work as the head of knowledge and practice for the construction and infrastructure sector for the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors, commonly known as RICS. Luckily, I have a global role, get to meet lots of our members and member firms and see what they are doing. I'm a construction guy primarily, and also dabbling a little bit into sustainability and decarbonization now. My journey has been mostly, I've been a researcher and a professor for most of my professional life, and I've worked in Canada, U.S., two innings in the U.S., two innings in India, one in Australia, and one in the U.K. So you could complain, because when I see folks celebrate their 27th year in an organization, I sometimes feel a bit confused, because I have gone to several places where I found opportunity. But that's maybe a positive as well. So most of the time I have anchored on the use of digital tools in my life. When I was in India, for example, I worked with several large players to promote the use of building information modeling. I know we are shifting away from BIM to more of information management, but at that time, it was still a new idea. About 10 years ago, did lots of workshops, worked with industry partners, and promoted. I started the BIM Student Challenge in India as well, where several students participated. So as a professional, I've always worked with industry, with other researchers, other scholars, worked with students, worked with industry professionals, but largely surrounding myself towards learning and contributing the role of digital tools in improving our sector.
Great. Thank you, Anil. And it's, I think, that's interesting. You've moved across different domains, or at least organizations. And I think that's, you know, there are surprisingly a lot of people who don't do that, and then they're stuck in their verticals. So I think it's really interesting, your perspective, you know, working across different organizations. Again, you mentioned information management, certainly in BIM. I'm sure we'll come back to BIM by name. But again, just for the benefit of people new to this podcast, I mean BIM in the sense of better information management. I full well know what it means in another context, which we will get to. But so we are certainly interested in that broader digitalization, which, again, is what you're focused on. So, well, I know one of the topics we were going to touch on, I think it would be great to start on this one, because it's one of your specialisms, is certainly around the importance of things like data standards linked to decarbonization and schemas. Now, this might seem unusual, but if you wouldn't just mind explaining what a schema is, because I've had to do that several times and I've been teaching. So just if you would, for the people that aren't a data professional, what is a schema and how do data standards and decarbonization link together?
So to first answer the question on what I think is a schema, schema to me is data plus knowledge about that data, meaning semantically what that data really means. Combining both together sort of gives you a schema. So it's not just unstructured data, but you also know what that data is telling you in terms of its metadata or its definitions. So schema sort of is underlying foundational layer for all activities that we do. One of the issues that we've generally faced as a sector, and that's and you can see that in the symptom, we've always struggled with this term BIM. You mentioned it's better information management. it was coined differently for different reasons. But it's clear in our struggle of using that term that it is not the right fit to what we are trying to accomplish in our sector. And that's becoming evident. And I like some of the global organizations shifting their name to more of an information management association or professional body that is influencing this issue globally. So that shift from BIM to IM and removing that struggle that we always had is, I think, the step in the right direction. Anecdotally, I was speaking at some conference and one of the participants who was an industry leader, he just said that whenever I go to these discussions, I see the use of digitalization in our sector as a bitter pill. But that probably was true maybe a few years ago. I would say 5 to 10 years ago, it was always a pain point. Even the use or the term digitalization was seen as, oh, it's like a medicine that I have to take and maybe it'll lead to some improvements. That has clearly shifted in our sector, and now people are embracing digitalization and seeing benefits in our sector. So with that, what has also happened simultaneously is that within our sector, the subdomains and the use cases in those subdomains are slowly shifting ourselves from what used to be called islands of automation to what I call islands of data standards and schemas. Case in point, in the UK, a new standard was released maybe about 6 months ago relating to a plant, automated plant that is on construction site. It's called CAPS, I think, Connected and Automated Plants and Systems on a Construction Site. It's a schema that helps you ensure that the real-time edge computing data that you're receiving from plants and equipment is structured. So that's a subdomain schema. Similarly, as you may know, in the UK, there was a fire information exchange standard also, or a data schema came out. Again, these are subdomain schemas which actually do not connect very well with existing standards, data standards and schemas, which then leads us to this issue of being able to map these subdomain standards, if you want to call them, because they're generally built by domain specialists without participation of information management specialists. I think time has come for us to bring that expertise of IAM into all standards and mapping of standards that we do. So then how does it connect to decarbonization? You know, right now, carbon is the loudest voice, but not the only voice in the construction sector. It's pretty much everyone, including me, is just very interested in seeing how we can drive decarbonization in our sector. So that's, in one way, is an overriding outcome that everyone is looking for. But then, at the same time, it's only probably a narrow sliver of the information management process that we take. So there are schemas and data standards helping decarbonization. For example, OpenEPD, which is a data standard for environmental product declarations that can be machine readable and can be exchanged more easily. But do they fit into the grander scheme of things like an IFC or other ISO and EN standards that are available on product data templates and building information modeling, for lack of other word, I'll still use BIM. So decarbonization gives us an opportunity to rethink how do we develop these data standards, how do we map before jumping into developing a new standard. Perhaps we should consider existing standards, and if those connected together serve our purpose, maybe that's the approach. But if a new standard is needed, we still need to see how they map into an existing standard like an IFC kind of approach, so that we stop this fragmentation of standards as we move forward. And they'll probably won't end up with islands of data standards and schemas. I know that's sort of a longish answer, but I wanted to sort of give you a background from where I'm coming in terms of the role of data standards and schemas for various use cases, in this instance, decarbonization.
Let's take a quick break.
Do you need help where to start with BIM and the ISO 19650 series of standards? If so, then our partners BIM Enable can help. Not only do they provide training, they can also offer implementation services and a strategic overview for your organization with a roadmap of what to do. They specialize in information management of all kinds, and BIM is just part of this, but also asset information management. So why don't you go to bimenable.com? That's bimenable.com. Great. Thank you. Yeah, because that context around the schema, I think, isn't understood by everybody. Let's put it that way. A lot of people might think that's the solution. Let's have a schema. And your point is there are some that work. They may not map on each other all the time. It may not be a one-to-one. And that's the challenge, isn't it? It's that sort of overarching approach, which is the challenge, and then do they map across different domains? What I guess leading on from the actual specific schema example or focus, how do we actually develop the use of digital tools broader, so more the technology and the digitalization piece as a whole to support decarbonization? I know we touched on it, we talked about schemas, but more broadly, what can we do? What are people doing? What have you been involved with?
Sure. So there are, just if you look at the decarbonization use case, it requires multiple pieces of puzzle to fit together. Obviously, you have policy, you have regulation, you have building bylaws, those issues that need to be addressed. But if you take a narrower focus on data and information needed for decarbonization, you will see broadly, I put it into three buckets. One bucket would be a reporting classification system, which helps everyone report in a systematic fashion. Why is that important? It's important because carbon needs to be made visible. If you are going to say we are accomplishing these targets and not harming the environment, we want to make sure that can be validated in an open and transparent fashion. So that's clearly already understood by the industry. And many standards and reporting systems exist, mostly at the organizational level, but not at the project and asset and below the project and asset level as well. So one piece that is required for an information management point of view is a reporting classification schema, system, standard, whatever you would like to call it. The second entity or item that you need in order to help decarbonization is a methodology or an how-to standard, which tells you how the system boundaries can be drawn, which modules in the decarbonization process are important, which assumptions you need to make, which data sources do you need to go and get, how do you handle uncertainty? Because, Stephen, you would imagine there's a lot of uncertainty in the underlying data on decarbonization. And the ranges can be 20%, 30% variation, very similar to the journey we took in cost estimation. The data uncertainty in cost estimation existed, but we have learned how to, even though performance on cost measures is sometimes not as expected, but still we have a better understanding. So similarly, there's a lot of uncertainty in the decarbonization data also. So the second piece is the how-to, which is very complex. If you think about new builds, existing assets, retrofits, renewals, you really can't do hand computations or fragmented computations of these decarbonization or carbon calculations. So you need digital tools to sit on top of the how-to guide. And as you may know, RICS has the world's leading standard called the Whole Life Carbon Assessment of the Built Environment Professional Standard, which was produced in 2017. On September 19th, this month, we will be releasing the second edition. And that second edition will provide a global methodology of buildings, so horizontal and vertical projects, infrastructure projects. It will connect to a reporting structure, which is internationally agreed and open. And it'll allow digital tools to sort of embrace the whole life cycle assessment, whole life carbon assessment methodology, and become sort of validated that those digital tools provide the framework in our standard. The last piece you need is data on benchmarks, on standards, both at the entity level and perhaps at the assembly and product material level. Because right now, the data that we have is primarily driven by two main drivers. One is a full-scale LCA, or life cycle assessment analysis. The other is driven by EPDs, or environmental product declarations. EPDs only provide information about products and materials, and that too for modules A within the life cycle assessment. So eventually, in order to become as a sector more proficient in decarbonization, we'll need benchmark standards and targets. And that need to be digitally stored, digitally available, so that the full cycle, if you only look at the digital aspects of decarbonization through reporting, through methodology, and through metrics, benchmarks that could be regional, national, or global, but digitally available are crucial. So I think digital is going to be a friend of decarbonization, but it can only be friendly to decarbonization if we have standards that not only link to, say, IFC, to the whole bigger picture of the schemas, but also support interoperability, support exchange of information, and is driven by an information management process that helps the whole team come together, the project team come together from concept till end of life.
Great. Thank you. That's a fantastic answer. And it's very comprehensive, because on the different levels that you've mentioned, particularly what I tend to find is people that are focused on the data digital side only don't talk enough about the process, and the methodology, the how-to. You articulated there, and again, this is for people listening or watching, is have you got anything just to add about the ability to model processes? Again, this might be stating the obvious to some people, but is that something you've seen or you foresee? So, for example, the how-to that you described, that could be modeled through the actual process, could be modeled. Have you seen that in any organizations, or is that something that RICS is talking about? So rather than just the schemas, the actual how do you do it, the interactions, the workflows, the procedures, have you got anything to add about that?
Sure. I think that's a very important point, because if you don't marry the two, you still have fragmentation and difficulty in adoption and implementation. So very particularly to what you said, Stephen, there are two examples that I'll give. One, obviously, is once you produce the how-to guide, you go to software vendors and ensure that the tool that they provide is compliant to this methodology. Many of the carbon calculators in the market right now are compliant to our whole life cycle, whole life carbon assessment, first edition 2017. So as we launch the second edition, we're going to go to our partners again and see if they can ensure that how-to is put into the software. And then if it is connected to other data standards, then both the process and the data sort of come together in a very systematic fashion. The other activity which we are exploring is, you know, there is a sector-agnostic push to trace carbon emissions of products. It could be in any sector. But you need to be able to digitally, machine-readable format, interoperably be able to track emissions of products that get used, maybe in car manufacture, maybe in manufacture of other kinds of products and widgets that you use. Obviously, construction will come into that also. So how do you create a schema that can sit beneath a process which can then help track your scope 3 emissions by tracking these product emissions over their life and connecting it back to the project and asset as well? So I think that's where the data standards and work practices come together. Another example, which is perhaps not related to decarbonization, but eventually will get integrated, is your QTO process, quantity takeoff process, which IFC, Building Smart International, is looking at and developing that process so that it can be married to the IFC schemas also. So essentially, eventually we'll have to combine cost and carbon together so that decisions can be made on material selection. That's an example of what we do when it comes to connecting work practices with data standards.
Let's take a quick break.
Don't forget, you can catch up on all our podcasts in video and audio by visiting our website at bim.tube. That's bim.tube.
Great, thank you. Yeah, and it's taking the step back, isn't it? You mentioned the EPDs, which are anything you say that maybe people aren't familiar with, I'll link to them as well if we haven't fully explained them. So certainly with EPDs, I was just thinking about that, linking them back from what you said, and then business process modeling is obviously another facet which we maybe won't get into, but you've articulated what that could be and is for people beyond the schemas, the modeling of the process.
But maybe I can add a little bit on
please.
EPDs. EPDs are like labels on your food tin. So if you buy something, it's going to disclose the agreed nutrients and other things that are part of that food product that you have. So very similar to that, the construction product would have a label. That label is called EPD. It's governed by ISO standards, and the emissions, especially the GWP, the global warming potential, in carbon dioxide equivalent is disclosed for a declared unit. So a label on ready-mixed concrete would essentially tell you what a cubic meter of ready-mixed concrete of particular strength and mix will emit if you bought that and brought it to your site. So that EPD is very crucial for us because it's like getting your cost information multiplied with the quantity. Same way you can use EPD's carbon intensity factor, multiply with the quantity of concrete, and you get the carbon footprint. Now, EPDs are slowly getting traction because you want to make them machine readable. So there are 3 ISO standards that help make these interoperable. The ISO 22033-337, the product data template standards, and then recently released ISO 22057, which is the EPD standard to work in a BIM environment. So these labels need to be interoperable, machine readable. So these standards together can come in, and your environmental product declarations can be made available. And globally now, these maybe 200,000 construction products have EPDs that you can scrape and pull into your software tool and use them in your calculations.
Great, thank you. And thank you for quoting the standards. Again, I'll link them for the benefit of people listening or watching. Certainly, a portion of my day job is teaching standards like the ISO 19650 standards. So having the standards that you just referred to, I mean, that's where the devil is in the detail. I mean, we need, like we're saying, prescriptive standards at that level. They can't all be framework standards, the ones that I'm used to. Something needs to go in the framework, which is what we're talking about today. Again, I'll certainly link to all of these. And I think it's really interesting talking about the EPDs, and you've explained what they are. And then I think about the logistics, you know, then we come on to the logistics of how that product gets to site. And obviously that was what you gave. I mean, have you got anything to elaborate on that? I often think about that. People say, oh, could we measure carbon? Obviously, I don't know a fraction of what you do as far as the detail, but nevertheless, I say, well, yeah, we can we could put a metric in there, and you've explained how we might go about that. Now, the logistics of how we go about at a high level, how do clients or the supply chain get a handle on where things come from? Have you got any sort of overview on how that oversight on the logistics of how things get to site happens?
I think that from an emissions point of view, that probably is very crucial as well. I know there are lots of logistics software, both for in situ construction and prefab or offsite construction, that can help track this logistics. So you need to layer those tools with carbon emissions data also, so that you can track. As you people familiar with decarbonization or the modules that are provided in the EN standards, you have the module A, which is the product module, where A1, A2, A3 are emissions that are in the manufacturing process of a construction product, so extraction, transport, manufacture. And then A4, A5 are essentially bringing them through the gates of our site, and emissions needed for assembly, installation, and all other site operations. So do we track electricity usage on our sites? We do. Do we track emissions from various equipment on our construction sites? Perhaps we do. And that's where, for example, I earlier explained CAPS, which is the connected and automated plant and equipment system standard. One of the data items in that schema is about emissions. So if you have a diesel-operated construction equipment moving around in the site and you have some kind of an IoT device, you could probably start tracking the usage and from that perhaps the emissions. So yes, I think technology is available, but it's a matter of connecting all these things together.
So thank you for that. And I just wondered if we could just move on to the document that you led, which is the RICS Digitalization and Construction Report 2023. I've read that. It's fantastic. Of course, I'm very passionate about all the content in there. But I know you've also cross-referenced the World Economic Forum as well, just in the header there. I don't know if you've got any links with the World Economic Forum or anything to say about that, that they seem to have metrics on how there'll be a 20% reduction in greenhouse gases around technology. Anyway, if you could just talk about your report, that'd be great. And any involvement you've had with the World Economic Forum would be great, just to sort of close the loop as well. Fantastic. Sure. Please.
Sure. So let me begin by giving you some background. RICS runs four times a year, Global Construction Monitor Survey, which is our sentiment-based survey run by our economics team. Simon Rubinson, our chief economist, runs those and has been doing that for many years. But it's a sentiment-based survey which goes out globally. We get anywhere from 5,000 to 6,000 responses, which is an amazing number. But what we have started doing with his permission is we've started adding questions every quarter to the Global Construction Monitor Survey. So in one quarter, we add, I think, four or five digitalization-related questions with the aim that every year we'll collect that data. This was the second year we did, but hopefully we'll continue to collect and see a journey that our sector is taking on digitalization. We have one quarter where we ask special questions on sustainability. So that's the cross link between decarbonization and digitalization. One quarter we ask specifically on construction productivity. So our hope is with tagging along these four or five questions, different ones every quarter, would give us insights that are maybe connected but are individually collected. So specifically in digitalization and construction, we broadly asked our respondents, what do they use? What benefits do they see? What obstacles do they have while using those digitalization tools? And what's the state of data and information sharing and collaboration truly happening and they are seeing? Because we talk a lot about information sharing and collaboration. That's one of the discussions that everyone engages in. But is it really happening? So with those questions, then we are able to distill this high-level insights into where digital tools, role of data and information management, and overall digitalization is taking us. One thing I would point out, from 2022 to 2023, the only thing that increased or improved was the number of respondents. But the status of use broadly of the digitalization remained more or less same. So we got that COVID bump, and then perhaps we just maybe are again slightly stagnating. So we need to have another push. The other thing that I would like to highlight, and obviously we can go into more detail in that report, is that the perceived benefits are very high, but the actual usage is low. So there is definitely a positive bias towards using these tools to the benefit and to create the right outcomes. But there must be some blockers, barriers that are stopping that that adoption implementation to grow. So we talk about those also. But what puzzles me the most is that the level of information sharing, data exchange for various functions, and we took, I think, quantification, cost planning, decarbonization, social value, ESG, those kinds of higher level functions, the level of information exchanged through digital models and tools is quite low. So clearly, we are still using sort of a fragmented approach of sharing those pieces of information amongst the project stakeholders and project team members. So as we go into the next cycle, hopefully we'll be able to see more distinguishing information that may provide additional insights into our work and how the journey is taking place. Now, to the connection with World Economic Forum, there is now a construction and infrastructure sector group within World Economic Forum. The program manager, Oliver, is helpful in seeing our reports and sharing it with their members. So we hope to collaborate even more, but that's the connection. We did one joint webinar with them as RICS and WEF, and we hope to continue that engagement because lots of data and information that they create and share is sort of coming from the same stakeholder group, but perhaps through senior management. We get to the grassroots, our members working in various projects and various aspects of those projects provide us those sentiment survey. So I think if we combine those, we may be able to get more useful insights.
Great, thank you. Yeah, that was my motivation just for asking about the World Economic Forum. So thank you for giving an overview to the report, first of all, is because, as you just explicitly said, there's a different, slightly different audience. I think that's always a challenge, isn't it, where RICS has a certain audience by definition. It has a broad audience, and I realize different audiences, but within reason, we know who they are. And I think that's the challenge, isn't it? How do we get to the ultimate clients, whether it's people in governments, whether it's, you know, how do we put a value, a metric? And I know you mentioned ESG. I know, again, there'll be lots of people very familiar with that. And of course, it's referred to in the reports and there's elements of it that we're talking about already. But could you just give an overview for what is ESG? For, again, there might be people that are not familiar with that reporting framework and the fact that it's a compulsion for some organizations, and how that should give us some opportunities that perhaps we've not had in the past. I think there's a real benefit. Could you just explain how it aligns to what we're talking about and what the potential opportunities are going forward?
Sure. So I think slowly we are realizing as a sector that outputs are important, but we need to connect them to project outcomes also. So as a project management person myself, I'm quite familiar with narrowly focusing on time, cost, quality, sustainability, safety, and those aspects. But then there are higher level outcomes that we need to connect to as well. So environmental, social, and governance is a set of outcomes that are being reported at perhaps an organizational level right now using various frameworks. There are so many reporting frameworks available. But at an organizational level, we can't reach those outcomes without layering and connecting them back to our assets and projects. And that's where we see the connection. Our focus largely, at least as you know, RICS has many, many pathways. Some of my colleagues look at the entire built environment lifecycle. I have a narrower view of construction, the design construction process. So within that, if you can roll up these metrics like carbon emissions and connect back to the ESG outcomes at the organizational level, that's what we are aiming for, because otherwise we'll again have some sort of a fragmentation between organizational level reporting requirements and asset and project level reporting requirements. So keeping that in view would at least help make that connection also.
Again, it's all these different concepts that seemingly can come up separately for people. For example, ESG, obviously your report brings them together, and obviously I'll link to it. The report we're talking about incorporating ESG principles is part of it, as well as overcoming the blockers is obviously one of the conclusion parts of it. And certainly this whole life asset approach, you've mentioned asset management or whole life asset management or whole cost. Again, I know they're not quite the same in my mind. Maybe they're synonymous sometimes, but have you got any observation on the fact that maybe still whole life cost and strategic asset management professionals aren't necessarily always talking to people who might be RICS professionals, or is there work still to be done? I definitely sit in both camps. I go to both kind of events. There is an Institute of Asset Management, for example, that most people will be aware of that originated in the UK. But do you see work to be done? So, how do we get the client to talk to people who are project focused? What do we do?
I think that's a very important point. So a few things that I would add. As a sector, we are very good at take one at a time approach. So this I read in an AIA, the American Institute of Architects article, that one of the very senior architects said, we're very good at looking at one thing at a time. So we get passionate about green and we just focus on green. We get passionate about lean and we just sort of focus. Time has come to integrate those. And that's where the outcomes focus is important. The second issue is that we have done and dusted the early contractor involvement issue, more or less. So we know what that is and what the benefits are. I think we've got to move on to early asset manager involvement, because they should dictate what needs to be embedded as an information management process into whatever they receive. They may receive a physical asset alongside with some digital assets, maybe a digital twin. But they should get what they are needing in order for the asset to be operated. So that link, I think, is still missing largely. Some large projects are now looking at saying, okay, asset managers, you need to tell us what you need. Obviously, you will get the physical asset, but what do you need from the digital assets that you will also receive so that you can smoothly turn on the switches, run the fans and the pumps and whatever else you need to run, and be able to operate and maintain and end of life and all those steps can be taken. I think we have gotten by without this integration. Now probably we can't, because carbon emissions do not stop at the project handover and then restart at the operation, maintenance and use and end of life stages. That is a continuous process. If we keep the fragmentation on, I think it'll be very difficult to make a case for decarbonization. And that's why from the get-go, folks who are jumping into decarbonization, including me, would see the idea of whole life carbon assessment. You would not do a capital carbon first and then worry about operational carbon, or what's called embodied carbon and then operational carbon, because it's a give and take. If you pick a material, it may have high embodied carbon, low operational carbon, maybe slightly low price, but you want that versus something that provides you a happy medium with cost, embodied, and operational carbon. And that can take place without us taking a whole of asset, a whole of life worldview as we jump into asset management and then downstream design and construction. And that solely depends on how we are able to integrate information management processes and receive input from downstream players.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Yeah, I know it was sort of a loaded question that I asked you, but I'd certainly agree with the point there's work to be done about joining these things up. I think with communications, however, there has to be something in it for everybody. Often I think that's not reflecting on what we've specifically talked about, but just making the case for where is the value or the benefit, however it's articulated, for people. There has to be something in it for people. You know, it's hard to offset the benefit, if you like. So, on that basis, although we've sort of moved away from the direct construction, I know there's another report that you've been involved with, RICS Construction Productivity Report. Now, I don't know if you wanted to introduce that and just describe what that was about and some of the findings from that, just to take it full circle. I know we've sort of parachuted up, we're talking about benefits, outcomes, but maybe to bring it back just to the construction side of it through that report.
Sure. Stephen, before I do that, I liked what you just said in terms of value. You know, one of the obstacles that I have seen and interacted with a lot of companies is the story of value proposition. Right? If you were a manufacturer of a pencil, for example, and somebody came to you and said, I'll automate, I'll bring you robots, I will do this machine, that machine, the value proposition is pretty straightforward or relatively straightforward. You say, I'm going to spend X dollars on an automated system, and it's going to increase my pencil production by 22%. Therefore, I will make in the first year this much money, and therefore clear value proposition, ROI, and whatever else you want to call it. But in our sector, it's not that easy. How do you say, give me the asset management folks up front, and we will then get improvements? How will the subcontractor get benefit or value from that? Articulating that value proposition is extremely difficult, and that has been a stumbling block. But there are folks who are doing that, are able to clearly articulate that value proposition. So you're absolutely right. I think if you don't create value through these interventions, it could be monetary, it could be any other type of value creation. Without that, I think moving the needle is a bit difficult. So that's on the value side, but you're absolutely right. So we sort of took a big picture view on construction productivity. It's a pretty tricky topic. Most people, if you read, it talks about stagnation of construction productivity. There are famous authors who have written about either declining or stagnating construction productivity. So we delved into that and we said, we're going to leave the sector level productivity aside because that's for the economists to worry about, because it uses input-output models and several other econometric measures. We're going to jump straight into more of worker productivity, project-related, activity-related productivity, and what are our members and member firms doing to enhance that. Now, the encouraging picture that emerges from there is investments in training is number one. Obviously, that makes sense. Investing in data and information processes is in the top three. Investing in automation robotics is there. Investments in digital tools is there, which is extremely encouraging. And then, as you said so rightly, it makes the full circle, that connection that we were looking for. Digitalization sits here, construction productivity sits there. And if these two say different things, then the connection is lost. But fortunately, the productivity report points back to digitalization. So it is crucial that we take that big connected picture and present it to the industry stakeholders.
Yeah, thank you. And I, again, obviously, I'll link to the report there. And I think it's like you say, or like we've both said now, like closing that loop, because you know, everyone has a different focus. And again, you've said yourself that you're focused on a certain area, you know, and other people are focused on other areas. And I think it is a challenge. One comment I often make at conferences is not reflecting on what you've said, but just about joining things up generally. I'll often say, well, it's all about communication, isn't it? It's about telling a story. We do need economic and measurable benefits behind it. But nevertheless, ultimately, there's hearts and minds, aren't there? So that the minds would be the logos, the numbers, the savings. There needs to be the hearts, the sort of the pathos or whatever, the story. You know, are people good at telling a story? I don't know what your thoughts are on this. And I think, I don't, again, nothing to do with your documents, just generally in AEC, architecture, engineering, construction and asset management, I think no, the stories haven't been that compelling, actually. You know, and then tragically, often the use cases and stories I use are where there's been tragically something like loss of life or something, for example, and we can think about certain fires and to do with products, for example. Have you got anything about that, about maybe some people need better storytelling? Not us, not you, but other people out there who aren't us. How do they, maybe they need help. There are communication professionals out there. Have you got anything to add about that?
I do, because we struggle with this all the time. It's what I say is building standards, technical data standards, gives you the credibility, but doesn't give you the message. And minus the message, it may be sitting in a silo. I mean, I don't know how many people have read our standards or use our standards, because perhaps that's where the weakness is. The weakness is in the messaging, the communication, and that's actually the hard bit. For us, I'm an engineer. If I get the right resources and the mindset, we can sit in a room and design a standard. But then it's like measuring the depth of the pond behind my house. Who cares, kind of a situation, till you make that importance known and the connection clarified. I think that is really the hard bit. Some folks are doing a good job, like we are Nina, the newly incarnated UK BIM Alliance, pushing information management, and I think tells a very good story. There are folks who are doing that, and I think we all need to get better at telling that message, telling the story. Obviously, there are going to be positive and negative aspects of what is experimented with. I mean, it's very difficult to read about what's happening in the schools in the UK with the reinforced aerated autoclave concrete. But still, nevertheless, I mean, there needs to be these stories told, lessons learned, and communication made more robust.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess not to prolong that point too much, but I will ask you directly. Certainly the knowledge management, which I obviously you know a lot about yourself, but have you got any thoughts on trying to capture knowledge? So we talk about standards. We've been talking about standards, then we're talking about maybe capturing processes, methodologies. And ultimately, I think as you go up the sort of, if you're thinking about the Gartner, not a hype cycle, but sort of the knowledge, you know, data, information, insight, knowledge, wisdom, or whatever. I think actually we're talking knowledge. Ultimately, we're talking knowledge management. People don't talk about that enough, because I always think you could have a trillion, whoever, one might have $1 trillion for data capture, right? But without that knowledge capture and the lessons learned, which we were just implying, you know, it's not going to go well long term. You've got anything to add about explicitly about capturing structured knowledge? You know, people retire, people leave, their knowledge goes with them. What do we do about that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very crucial aspect. And before even I say that, if you look at various standards that are available right now, I'm not pointing towards myself or anybody else, but in general, these are PDF documents. Some entities are shifting and changing. I know they're producing APIs. They're producing other more digitally savvy way of distributing those standards. But these are PDFs. So how do you expect to move into the next digitalization stage or transform their use if you're still looking at flat PDFs? So that's one issue. The second issue, obviously, is there is knowledge and wisdom embedded in these standards. So I recently took one of our very popular standards, which is like 1,100 pages, and fed it into ChatGPT. And I can then query and see what page number, what is said, for example, rules of measurement. Now, that's a lower level knowledge management issue where at least I can get induction processes for new employees who want to learn about our rules of measurement, the new rules of measurement, NRM 1, 2, and 3. You can have this kind of an intelligent knowledge-based interface where they pick up that very quickly rather than reading 1,100 pages. But really what you're talking about is capturing what's going out of our doors because of retirements, people leaving the sector, and so on. I think that has been an age-old struggle. How do you capture that knowledge and wisdom and bring it back to projects? Luckily, AI is helping there as well. I know several startups and well-established AI providers, you must be familiar with them also, can then now go and dig into thousands and thousands of previous decisions you had made on how to put a pump together on a construction project. It can bring you those best case, best examples, and share with you the right decisions you made and avoid you making bad decisions. So that's, I think, a very interesting area where it's happening in on risk management, it's happening in scheduling, it's certainly happening in contract documents and other kind of documentation that our sector uses. So I think slowly there is hope that with fine-tuned AI models, we will be able to gather some of this information and use it. Because I think one of the fragmentations we don't address is what I call the longitudinal, and it's in literature also, longitudinal fragmentation, learning from project to project. Especially cost, time, schedule, those kinds of, and risks, we can easily learn lessons from there also. Because these previous past bad and good examples have been done by seasoned folks who may be walking out the door with the knowledge they have. So if we can't capture it directly from them, at least we can go back into the decisions that they had made and use these advanced tools to bring that knowledge into our organizations so that we don't repeat making the same mistakes on new projects. Sometimes we do that as a sector. So I think that's where knowledge management becomes crucial ultimately, because you may have millions and millions pieces of data. I remember early on in my career, I, through Freedom of Information Act, asked local building departments to share with us building inspection data. So foundation inspection passed or failed, why did it fail? We got over a million records. Now, those records are useless if you can't, as you said, in that hierarchy, give wisdom to the end user. So today, that's quite possible. You can process that information because embedded in those problems is somebody's knowledge of how the inspector failed that inspection. So I think that's probably something that is worth exploring.
Great, thank you. And you mentioned the longitudinal, the over time. It's good to think of that, isn't it? Because the digitalization or whatever we call it, the investment, it is an investment now for someone in the future. Again, I'm just obviously paraphrasing about some of the elements that we've been talking about. But I think that's what people don't get sometimes. They go, oh, will it cost more to do it this way or that way? I say, well, there will be efficiencies perhaps in construction, but it's an investment. Again, even talking about whole life past a whole life of a physical asset or even a digital asset, it's an investment. We're investing for the future. And again, I just thought I'd reinforce that. Often I think I originally have a background in GIS, so for the benefit of people listening and watching, so the digital mapping and analyses. And I think, yeah, there's an investment. It's sort of like space-time, isn't it? I'm sort of going off on a tangent here. But I often think we're investing now for and for information management for someone else, probably in a different location, the space, and then in the example you talked about, longitudinal, in a different time. There'll be someone in the future. And anyway, I like to draw parallels between the actual data itself and the usage of it. Maybe it's getting a little bit meta here, but I think it is quite hard to get people's heads around that concept because it is sort of abstracting. And we're talking then about metadata, aren't we? We're talking about... again, maybe there's nothing to add on that. We've probably talked that point out, but have you got anything just generally to talk about metadata? And maybe we've talked about schemas, but the concept of metadata and archiving things and being able to retrieve data still probably needs to be improved. Have we got anything to add, or have we already touched on that?
I think we have, but very briefly, what I would say is now we have the capacity to treat unstructured data through AI and other tools. That's good. We should definitely tap into that. But eventually, to bubble up that knowledge and wisdom hierarchy, you need to have metadata. You need to have a data dictionary that understands a door here is called something else somewhere else. So when mining all the knowledge and data, or the data to decipher knowledge, you still need that metadata or that schema or that data dictionary, which I guess Building Smart International produces, the BSDD, which tries to connect these semantically. So I think eventually we can't lose sight of both branches. Keep treating the unstructured data as rest of the sectors are doing. They look at customer reviews and they can tell you what's happening. Let's continue doing that. But then we also need to focus as a sector on more structured data, information, knowledge, wisdom that can be deciphered only if we know what that data is telling us in terms of its metadata or its schema. So both are actually equally important.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, certainly I've more recently shifted my position on this, where of course we need, as you've just said, the structured data, but AI until relatively recently wasn't that developed. So it gives me a different perspective on my position is always don't capture things we don't know any immediate use for, because it's for example, point cloud laser scanning. But I'm starting to rethink my thoughts now, because feature extraction is a very specific example, is quite feasible now. So you think, well, actually, in the future, there probably is more value than one might think in some unstructured data. So, my time is almost up with you, unbelievably. So thank you again. But there was one topic which I know we've touched on. You mentioned skills and upskilling, and that's obviously in one of the reports that we mentioned. But have you got anything to add specifically around skills, if we didn't mention it already, because we did touch on this, around digital skills and competencies? Are there any specific gaps or activities that you think we need to improve?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Stephen. It would have been silly if I didn't talk about that at all. Because as RICS, that is extremely crucial to us, right? We have an education and qualification standards framework through which we sort of impact to some extent what's taught in universities and colleges, and to a large extent impacts how members enter the profession. So in order to become an RICS member, you go through that EQS framework, as we call it, the Education and Qualification Standards Framework. Influencing that and making it ready for the current market conditions is most crucial. Do we have information management and digitalization as part of that framework or not? If not, obviously we are behind. So it's extremely crucial. Similarly, sustainability and decarbonization needs to be part of that framework through which members are qualified, through which university students perhaps get the experience of what's happening in the real world. So skills and competencies actually come up as blockers when we talk to our members about, let's say, decarbonization and taking on services to do decarbonization on assets, both new builds and existing assets. So I think the skills and competency agenda is extremely crucial. I remember from my engineering days, I don't think in my studies anyone ever talked about decarbonization, or anyone talked about the social aspects of engineering projects, even if they did very briefly. But those are becoming crucial, and they need to be integrated into the skills and competency framework overall. So I think it's, as I'm a member of the RICS also, so as a member, I think it's extremely crucial that we keep our eyes and ears open to this shift that's happening in how we approach projects and assets.
Great, thank you. And again, I'll link to the appropriate RICS pages where people can find out more information about what you've talked about. But in my mind, certainly whether it's digital or digitalization or similar concepts, in the parallel or sort of some analogy I like to give myself is around health and safety. I know, completely different sector, but I think, well, we've improved a lot, certainly in the UK, around health and safety on and in construction, as it happens. And I think, well, some people have to be experts, for example, in health and safety. Some people need to know what they need to know, but everybody's involved with it, and it's embedded in their working practices. Now, I like to think some analogy maybe with the digitalization, some people have to be experts, some people have to know some of the standards and the terms, the jargon that we need, but probably most people don't. It needs to be embedded in their working practices. So I think, so I just reflect on that when I think about the skills, because it's a balanced approach, isn't it? So anyway, thank you so much for your time. I could go on, but I've definitely had my time. That you've mentioned some documents, and I will link to them and references. Is there anything else you might want people to look up as a reference, or any perhaps even physical or virtual events that you might recommend people attend? But I know we've mentioned quite a few things already, but is there anything else you wanted to add?
Sure. But before that, I'd really like to thank you, Stephen. I think folks like you are really helping spread the word, share the message. And I think with you inviting me to talk to you, I'm really delighted and honored. We do run events. We have upcoming what we call World Built Environment Forum Summits. These are regional, one happening in the UK, I believe, next week, one happening in Europe in October. And then we run a virtual global summit, which normally happens in January. And this will all be available on our website. And I'm happy to share lots of links with you, and you can plug them at the appropriate. We run a global virtual construction and infrastructure conference, which is generally in May. And it sort of follows the sun. So we begin in Sydney and end in New York. So it takes virtual sessions run through that entire period. And I can share that link also with you when it's available. It's generally in May every year. And we have lots of webinars on decarbonization. We run webinars on our standard, the International Cost Management Standard, which is a coalition standard that RICS is part of. So lots of information that we provide on our website through our events and training and learning and development, which I'm happy to share.
Great. Thank you very much, Anil, and thank you for the kind words. I do enjoy talking to people like yourself with the experience that you've got, and I think it gives me a new passion for these things. You know, the application of what we know makes it all important. So thank you so much for your time sharing what you have today. I sincerely appreciate it. But with that, I'll have to thank you and close the podcast. I'm sure there'll be a part two. There's lots more we could talk about. But for now, thank you very much, Anil Sahoni. So thank you very much indeed.
Thanks.